Hello, my name is Dr. Thomas Round. I'm the RCGP Essential Knowledge Updates Clinical Lead. And today I'm talking about suspected familial breast cancer with Dr. Nicola Weaver. Hello, Nicola.
Hello.
Nice to talk to you today. And Nicola, as I said, your background, you're a GP and cancer lead in London.
That's right, a clinical cancer lead. It's in Southwark in southeast London.
And yeah, today we're talking about an updated NICE guideline. So many GPs might have heard of this previous guideline. It's recently been updated. But yeah, just a bit of background about suspected familial breast cancer. What do we mean and what does this updated guideline mean to us?
The main change that was made, is my understanding, in the update to the familial breast cancer guideline was that they took out a sentence that said we should not actively seek to find out from people if they had a family history of breast cancer, but simply respond if they brought the subject up, which was a very kind of discriminatory sentence in the opinion of a lot of people, because, you know, that left those that were educated enough to understand there could be an issue able to access information and those that weren't not being prompted about it. So that was really the main change. The other things that have changed are the licensing of the drugs, particularly the ones recent is the drugs that are used for primary prevention. I mean, so the two main drugs are tamoxifen and anastrozole. And anastrozole was recently given a license. Tamoxifen had had a license for this use for a few years, but is being underused nationally for a variety of reasons.
I mean, just obviously broadly thinking about breast cancer, I mean, GP will obviously be aware of that, the sort of pathways. And now, as I stand, obviously, breast cancer is the most common cancer in the country, right? And the lifetime risk is around 1 in 8 for women.
That's right, yes.
And so obviously with the prospective familial cancer guideline, we're thinking about identifying that small proportion of these total cancers which have potentially BRCA genes. Obviously these are rare, maybe underdiagnosed, but if you have that gene, you are significantly higher risk.
You are. I mean, I think what you say slightly misrepresents the situation in terms of the familial component, that the vast majority of people who get breast cancer won't have the BRCA genes.
Oh, yes. Yeah, absolutely. I agree.
But those people, it's increasingly known that polygenic inheritance with either inherited or newly occurring mutations in a variety of genes are also a major factor in breast cancer. So that is a different form of inherited breast cancer with a wider and less easily identifiable cause, because there's no single cause. And in both cases, both with the BRCA genes and with the polygenic inherited factors, they're all affected by environment and the usual things that we talk about in every disease, which is specifically weight, exercise, diet, alcohol, smoking. They're all there in cancer. So these things are all tied up together. And so I think to kind of represent it as a separate thing is wrong. So even with BRCA gene, you will have less risk of breast cancer if you maintain exercise and a healthy weight and avoid alcohol.
Yeah,
so,
yeah,
you know, I think it's important not to think of them as separate.
Yeah, I think that's important to say. And as you mentioned, there's modifiable risk factors, obesity, smoking, lifestyle, etc. And then obviously we're kind of focusing in on that non-modifiable risk factor, which is the BRCA gene, which is inherited, which is the well-known one. But I understand that women of Jewish ancestry, particularly Ashkenazi and other Jews, would be of higher risk potentially.
If you're talking about BRCA genes, yes. So women of Ashkenazi, and there's another, I've forgotten the exact name of it, but another Jewish ancestry are. Mm. And the NHS has set up a website where anybody who has a grandparent who is out of one of the two specific Jewish ethnic backgrounds can contact directly, and people can have a conversation about whether they are specifically likely to be at high risk, and they will go on and if genetic testing is needed, I understand it's being organised through that. So that's 5 to 10%, I think, of people who get breast cancer overall is what I recall. But there are also, though, going back to the polygenic risk factors, there are studies going on where people are looking at what they might be. And if you, as a person with a family history of breast cancer, are referred or self-refer, as you can in a lot of areas, to a family history clinic, they will give you a very complex questionnaire to fill in, which is really looking at all the different types of cancer that have occurred in all of the members of your family, going to cousins and grandparents. And that information, it's possible to use analytical programs to estimate whether you have an increased risk of breast cancer from that polygenic inheritance.
That's super interesting. I've had a look at this before and I've read the module, but I always struggle and I have to look it up every time about the family tree, which are the criteria for when you think that a woman is at higher risk. Because obviously, as we said, the lifetime risk is about 1 in 8, but it's kind of working out what makes a woman at a higher lifetime risk and at a higher lifetime risk to refer to a family history clinic.
The simple answer is just save the page. I mean, it's complex and I couldn't actually roll off all the situations to you from memory. I would always look it up. I don't see, you know, we've all got easy access to the internet. Someone comes and says, I've got family history breast cancer, and they tell you who it is. You can look it up. I think you shouldn't actually try and remember it or feel like you're somehow failing because you can't remember it. It's, you know, there's a lot of things to remember and none of us are going to remember them all correctly.
Yeah. Some key ones, I think, which is important. And I guess it's also sort of flagging up how we look that up and also how women might access that information themselves. But obviously mm-hmm. that does bias to women, as you note, women who are educated mm-hmm. and can look mm-hmm. this information up. So there is always that concern in my mind about the inequality, which I think you touched on a little bit.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's a much bigger issue that we need to be proactively communicating with women about their breast cancer risk and the potential for decreasing that risk. The family history guidelines for a professional, though, are available on the NICE website in the Familial Breast Cancer Guideline. It's very easy to find.
It's got quite an easy to use table to yeah. have a look at. And any sort of other tools that you've come across? I know that I've seen some people using, I think it's previously BRDC or CanRisk scores.
There are various things built into systems. So there is one that calculates for various different cancers in an EMIS. I'm not sure that that is necessarily based on the latest evidence. I don't know about that. I wouldn't use it personally. A lot of the ones that I've seen around start to get into the business of doing this very complex family history. And I think that's, like you say, easy to do. Well, not easy to do. I tried doing it, actually. You're better off in a family history clinic. They're usually nurse-run clinics where somebody will sit down with you and help you go through the process of identifying what risk factors there are in your background. So I think the key thing is family history clinics. And simply, if someone comes and says, you know, my mother, my sister, my grandmother, two aunts have had breast cancer, then I would be referring them for them to be assessed, having checked in the guidelines, if it is referable. Where I'm working, there's an open access that patients can access the website so they can actually do that themselves.
That's really good. Obviously, we try and encourage that more for patients yeah. to be able to access that information. Mm-hmm. And I think, look, one of the key things is we probably won't refer that many women. It's been a while since I've referred someone. So I think it's just really understanding, especially as trainees or moving around the country, there'll be different referral pathways in your different areas. It should pretty much be that every area would have a familial genetic referral pathway that you should be able to refer into.
They should, but when I was involved in a piece of work about 3 years ago where we were looking at this, there are certainly areas of the country that are underserved for this. So I couldn't immediately say you will have this pathway, but everybody will have a genetics department who will be responsible for giving advice. I think there's a big problem around this. I think this is something that really needs to be brought to light in a big way, because it seems to me that, you know, this is a situation where there's effective advice and effective drugs to prevent the most common cancer in women. And most women are not really aware of that. And I think in comparison to statins, there was a big national movement to make people more aware of their risk of heart disease and to promote the use of statins because they're very effective. But I feel like we're not seeing that in this case. And I don't really understand why. Or to a degree, I do understand why. But and partly that's about processes in the NHS and the way this information has evolved. So, for example, if you end up in a family history clinic currently where I work and you're assessed as being somebody who would benefit if you wanted to take it from the drug tamoxifen, there's actually no process that allows that to happen without some degree of discomfort in the system, because geneticists don't write prescriptions. The family history clinic is run by a nurse who doesn't write prescriptions. NICE defines tamoxifen and anastrozole as secondary care initiated drugs, but nobody's initiating them. So you end up with hospital departments writing letters to GPs to ask them to start a drug that they've got no familiarity with starting, which does have some side effects, and asking them outside what are the current NICE guidelines. So this is a problem, and it's a problem, as far as I'm aware, everywhere except Manchester, where they have an excellent clinic which is run by an oncologist. So he starts the medication, and they have on their website really good patient women-based information, because of course these people are not patients, they're just women, they're not ill.
Absolutely. I think that's really important to note, that you kind of feel slightly stuck in the sort of system we're working in, you know, either a commissioning gap or a service gap,
and there isn't there really absolutely is.
As I say, I've probably prescribed tamoxifen reasonable amount. Probably that's more common in women to prevent secondary recurrence of their breast cancer.
Yes, that is different, but that has been initiated by a clinician who's used to initiating the drug, and they manage any side effects that arise. We just continue a prescription that's been started in a shared care situation we're familiar with. In this situation, they're asking us to manage a drug that's not kind of licensed for us to do that, if you regard the NICE guidelines as being, you know, a significant determinant of how you behave, which I think we all do. I think they're very good. They allow us to prescribe safely. And so I think GPs are being put in a difficult position.
I agree with your point. We'd be rare that we'd initiate these drugs, but we'd be happy to continue it if someone's been counselled and the sort of risk benefit. And as I understand, moving in the new guideline, the changes with around anastrozole, which again, I think some of us will have heard of, it's probably less likely we've prescribed it. As I understand, it's a safer medication with less side effect risks. Yeah, with tamoxifen, there is a small but attributable VTE risk with tamoxifen.
They are drugs that are prescribed in a different situation. So tamoxifen, if you use it post-menopause, there's an increased risk of endometrial cancer. So it's no longer used post-menopause unless there's, you know, circumstances which make that risk kind of acceptable to the patient and the person prescribing it. Tamoxifen pre-menopause is a very safe drug. It has about the same venous thrombosis risk as the contraceptive pill. And we don't regard the contraceptive pill as a dangerous drug. Anastrozole has its own side effects. Anastrozole has been licensed in postmenopausal women because it doesn't work in premenopausal women. It's an aromatase inhibitor. So what it does is prevent the conversion of androgens produced in the adrenal glands to estrogens in peripheral fat tissue. So because of the way it works, it potentially can cause osteoporosis and there's an increased risk of fractures with anastrozole. Whereas, in fact, tamoxifen has a reverse effect. It's a selective estrogen receptor uptake drug. It actually decreases osteoporosis in people that are taking it. So I think it's wrong to kind of paint them as anastrozole safer. It's safer in postmenopausal women. It doesn't really work very well in premenopausal women because they have a lot more androgens in their system, so it just isn't as effective. In my personal experience, I've seen more side effects from anastrozole than I have from tamoxifen.
But as you note, it's important to note that we wouldn't be likely initiating these unless we've got some specialist training or that's the sort of commissioned service in primary care. Well, that wouldn't be usual practice.
Exactly. But, you know, it is the case that people are being sent letters saying, can you initiate these drugs? Which I think it's a major issue that needs sorting out in the system. I think if you as a GP are asked to do that, I would strongly suggest you write back to the person that sent you the letter and say, read the NICE guidelines. We're happy to, you know, under a shared care agreement, prescribe this drug, but it needs to be initiated by someone who's familiar with it.
Yeah, obviously there's other options for women who identified at high risk. So we talked quite a bit about chemo prevention and we did talk about lifestyle measures as well.
Our job there is to identify or make people aware that if they've got Jewish ancestry, there's a system for them to be assessed and to be, you know, to discuss that. It's not something we're likely to get very much involved with as a general practitioner, whereas we see a very, very large amount of women who have got a family history of breast cancer and in whom, if they look at the lifestyle interventions that they can make themselves, can make a very big difference to their risk. And the bigger your risk is, the larger the benefit you will get from making those changes. So, for example, excess weight is an increased risk factor in postmenopausal women, but actually not in premenopausal women. There's a very, very good resource on the NHS website, which was previously an e-learning for health module on prevention of breast cancer, which I'd really encourage everybody to do. And it spells out the amounts of change that you would expect to see from each of these things. And they're really quite large. So I think first of the straightforward things that, you know, people can do themselves. So weight, alcohol, smoking and exercise make a vast difference.
Thank you for a great discussion. And I totally agree. I think there's a lot of issues here to unpick around provision of services and reducing inequalities.
It would be great if this was part of every kind of new patient check, every NHS health check. Have you got a family history of cancer? Are you aware that, you know, that all these lifestyle things affect your risk of breast cancer? You know, we know they're important in heart disease, but most people don't know that they're important for reducing your risk of getting cancer. Given the frequency of the illness, it's important not just for the individual, but for the economy and for the NHS use of services and for the family. Preventing cancer is enormously important because of the knock-on effects it has for everybody. So when you talk about being in an area where it's deprived, I think in those situations, it's twice as important to highlight to people that there's things you can do to prevent illness.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, obviously we're funded for cardiovascular checks, which are slightly controversial whether they help. But, you know, actually it's a common themes around for chronic disease about reducing the risk factors for developing chronic disease and how we might tie those in together around, as you say, the common risk factors for those, considering also that one in two of us will get cancer in our lifetimes.
In a way, I think that that's a sign of success insofar as cancer is predominantly a disease of old age. I mean, there are other factors relating to breast cancer risk. So one of them is late menopause. Estrogen is a big factor in causing breast cancer. So women who've had periods and cycles for longer are at greater risk of getting breast cancer. You know, these are just things that it would be useful for women to know themselves so they can have agency and, you know, be able to think about how they manage their own risk.
really helpful. Thank you, Nika. And just to signpost people to the RCGP e-learning website. So as I say, we've got a recent updated module going through this area of familial breast cancer and assessing risk. We've also got some modules on cancer detection in primary care. With my other hat on, I've helped write some of those. So do have a look at those, and they can be really helpful to have a think about cancer in your own practice. And just to say thank you, Nicola, for all your work in this area. I really appreciate discussing this with you today.
Thank you. Nice to talk to you.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. You're listening to RCGP Podcasts. Thanks again.